Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It is Connor here.
And Gabe.
We're going to start off this time not with emails, but with comments.
And on YouTube or what?
On YouTube. Huh. Yeah, nice little reminder that we are on YouTube. Science Unscripted is on YouTube. The channel is called DW Podcast because there you can find all sorts of podcasts.
And there you can watch us instead of just listening to us.
Yeah.
Which just enhances the experience.
Well, I might say it detracts from the experience. You can decide. I'm just going to read a couple comments. One that sort of, it just made me happy. There's nothing really else to it. It's from Kachira. Her name is Kachira 2012, which means she might be 12, which it's great. If we're reaching...
If that's her birth year.
True.
What if she just loves that year, 2012?
It was a fun year, but
turning point in her life. You never know.
In general, we are happy when our content somehow reaches young people. That's pretty cool. And she just says, a nice find. I use YouTube mostly, even for listening on the go, and I like DW News, so it's a win-win. So she found our channel for the first time. One other comment here. This is from George Robinson. It was about our interview with Edwin van Leuven.
Chimpanzee expert.
Chimpanzees and this vending machine experiment and how you could teach a chimpanzee to do something that it couldn't do, and then it could teach other chimps.
A chimp on its own can't innovate and figure it out, but if you teach one of the chimps, that knowledge spreads to the group.
That's the whole point, and how significant that is for all of human civilization, that we can do that. He says, this is one of the best interviews I've watched, and it has 103 views. What the hell, guys? Like, internet? Is he complaining to the internet? Watch this now. Since then, it's gone up. And my prediction to George was, I wrote him back and said, or I left a comment, give it a week. I think we'll be at 10 or 20 billion views, which would make it the most viewed.
10 or 20. As if there's no difference between 10 billion
views. That would
views.
Make it the most viewed video possibly of all time. But yeah.
More than Gangnam Style?
That has been survived. Oh, come on. You're stuck in the past, my man. I think that got passed up by Despacito, who has been passed
Despacito.
Up by something else. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So last one here. This is from Dorothy and another person commenting on the toxic masculinity interview we did a while back. And she was just saying that she wants to feel safe in this world. And it basically angers her, but it frightens her to imagine the world that, in that case, influencer Sterling Cooper was describing as his kind of ideal, one where big, burly, kind of muscly men are...
Protect women.
Are protecting women and approaching them that way, kind of as like objects to be protected. And her comment was about how...
And that she wouldn't feel safe in a world like that? Is that...
No. She wouldn't. She doesn't want that world. She writes specifically, I prefer to have normal men around who are kind and will not play dominant, but approach me as a normal human being with equal rights and respect of boundaries, the same as I would approach them if I wanted to.
And no need of protection necessarily.
Yes. So that connects directly to some of the problematic messages being delivered through or by toxic masculinity influencers. I keep seeing, ever since we had that interview, I've seen so many random comments, often from teachers, saying that they're sensing this messaging coming into the classroom in really young boys. Watch out for that. And try to talk to young people about that. If you have kids, talk to them about how there's a lot of stuff on the internet that is just not good. I mean, we all know that. But that, it's important to treat.
But in particular, that it can seep its way into adolescent psychology, as
very
well.
Quickly, very young, yeah. Very young.
Particularly, that kind of message gets around quickly.
You've got some science.
I got melatonin is a hormone.
Sleep.
It's that hormone that our body sends that puts us to sleep or starts the process of falling asleep. In the morning, you go outside. And melatonin goes down because the sun is out. It's bright. At night, it goes up and starts that sleep process.
This is like a thermometer that when it reaches the top, my body's like, oh, time to go to bed.
Yeah, the light goes away, the melatonin goes up.
The light comes out and the melatonin drops.
Right, and a specific kind of light, blue light, short wave frequency light, so that if we are looking at our smartphones, at our screens, at night, the melatonin stays down. It's suppressed. There was a study done on this out of the University of Salzburg, and they wanted to look at different ways of reading. So they had three different ways of reading, and they looked at two groups, young kids and young adults, so mm-hmm. between 14 and 17 and 18 and 25.
Mm-hmm.
And they had them read smartphones with one of these blue light filters, so which takes away that shortwave frequency light that we were just talking about.
Yeah, this would be like, I would imagine, a translucent decal type thing that you would put over.
Warm light.
You would stick the translucent sticker over your phone's surface, right?
Either you do that or you tell your phone and its preferences to be a warmer light.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. You can do it that way. And then the third way is by reading a paper book. So you've got smartphone with the filter on.
A paper book?
Yeah. One of those books that you hold in your hand.
A what?
You turn the pages on it. Okay. And they wanted to see what happened in these two different groups. So young kids and adults, young adults. And what happened was in both groups, if you were reading without this filter on, so if you had this blue light getting into you right mm-hmm. before going to bed, mm-hmm. your melatonin went down or was suppressed, right?
So you're giving your body a signal. No.
Don't go to bed. Don't start that sleep process.
Yeah.
Right?
It'd be like drinking.
So in both groups that happened.
You're giving your eyeballs caffeine, right?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly it. And for the young kids, they were able to recover quickly or more quickly than the younger adults, than these adults, right? So the older you were, the less able you were to get that sleep process going, even if you were looking at a smartphone, right? So the smartphone was worse for you when you were old. And they also put these people into a sleep lab called polysomnography, wanted to look technically at the quality of their sleep. And these older people had worse sleep, less of this restorative deep N3 sleep. But according to subjective assessments of their sleep, there was no difference.
Oh, see, that's important. So they both groups thought they slept well or as poorly or as well.
Thought there was absolutely no difference.
But there was. And if you extrapolate, the older you get, the more you flood your eyeballs with this blue light, possibly the worse your sleep quality is going to be, and the stronger the effect that it'll keep you awake when you don't want to be awake.
So tips from this study, first of all, just put the phone away at night. Mm-hmm. In the last hour before you go to bed, just don't look at it at all. If you do, put on the blue light filter. If your phone has that function, put it on, because it will definitely have an effect on the melatonin levels, and probably that will have an effect on the quality of your sleep. If you're saying, I don't care, I'm just going to take a melatonin supplement, there was another study, there was work done late last year in the United States, this is, melatonin levels in kids, or they wanted to do a survey across the United States to see what percentage of parents were giving their kids melatonin, and it was up to 20%.
Wow.
In school-age kids, even preschoolers, 6% of preschool kids.
Oh, so this is like the old stories you hear about, rewind 100, 150 years ago. Here's a dash of whiskey before bed. Here's some opium.
There has been no research done on what it's a hormone, on what this hormone does to the developing mind, right? Does it get in the way of puberty? Does it screw with glucose metabolism? We don't know.
Do we know now?
No.
Oh,
we still don't know.
Oh, so parents.
The survey was just to figure out what percentage of parents are giving their kids melatonin. It's crazy. One in five kids is on melatonin, and one out of four of those. I mean, this is a lot of numbers, but a quarter of those one in five are taking it every night.
So instead of doing that,
put your smartphone away.
Put your smartphone away. I'm going to retract a tip that I gave in the past, which was to use a smartphone lockbox.
Because what? You had one and it didn't work?
It broke. Too fast. I ordered a cheap one on the internet, and that's my fault. So that's what I'm retracting. Don't order a cheap one on the internet.
Yeah.
Order a device. What it does, you put your phone in it, you set how many hours you want it to be locked away from you, which I cannot explain what a relief that is, because you don't need any willpower not to touch your phone. It's gone.
You cannot make a choice.
You're not forcing yourself not to. It's locked up, except mine isn't locked up anymore. It's because the thing's broken. So that's,
you got some science for me?
I do.
We are limited on time. Our studio tech wants to get out of here. So come on.
No, I know. I know. He's got to catch his train. So I will make this quick.
Yeah.
I was, obviously, you and I take a look at a lot of studies every single week. Yeah. I was stopped in my tracks.
When?
This week.
Physically?
You
couldn't move?
Yeah, I was... I think 8 minutes passed before I could even blink. No, the
That's
issue.
That's why you were so weird. No.
The issue was there was a study that came out that seemed to completely contradict a study that you and I not only reported on, but where we got in touch with the researcher from Norway. That study was on sexual norms or perceptions, how men perceive women and how women perceive men when they are sexually active. Do you remember, Gabe, that interview and that...
This was double standards, wasn't it?
Sexual double standards. And actually, I'm going to quiz you on, because you've got a pretty good brain for names.
Yeah.
Do you remember the researcher's name?
Leif Erik Olsson. Leif...
Very close.
Leif...
Edvard...
Edvard...
Odesson...
Olsson...
Kinnear.
Kinnear. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So that was the guy we talked to. We're going to go back to him in just a minute here. German study from Saarland, from the south of Germany, came out and said that society, it basically confirmed everything you already thought.
Okay.
If you're a man...
What did I think?
What most people usually think, if you're a man who has a lot of sexual partners,
yeah,
everyone's like, woo-woo.
That's fine.
You're a great
good
person.
Good on you. Good way to go, bro.
Yeah. Nice work. If you're a woman, you're only viewed more favorably if you have fewer partners, right? That's what society... And I'm thinking that completely contradicts this guy we talked to, except that it doesn't.
He was referring specifically to Norway, Norwegian society?
Not even that. It's deep in that. What this German study did was asked Germans to kind of imagine what they thought society would say. And in that sense, they're not necessarily wrong, because it's very possible that
extrapolating?
Yeah, you're guessing, like, based on TV shows and people you've talked to, how they would judge.
Okay.
I don't know if that's very important. I mean, it's important to some people to know how am I going to be perceived by society at large, of course. But I think it's a nice time to return to what I believe is the far more important research itself.
Yeah.
We're going to listen to a clip from Leif where he talks about how, if you ask people, how do you feel about a sexually active man or woman? This is what they say.
Science. Unscripted.
My name is Leif Edward Ottesen Kinnear. I am Professor of Psychology at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, and we've recently published a study on sexual double standards. General opinion in society is that we do have a sexual double standard where women's sexual liberty is somewhat reduced compared to men, and men are sort of heroes if they have a lot of sex.
Right, so the idea that a guy who has lots of partners is a stud, right? It's a good thing, it's a positive, and women, if they've had multiple partners, they are considered promiscuous, right?
Right, so I suppose promiscuous is laden somehow, but if one just uses it as a descriptor, promiscuity is then considered positive for males and negative for women. That is the myth in society, or that's what people believe. And this is what people say that is true if you ask them, what do other people believe? So what is the norm in society? If you ask people that kind of question, this is what they will confirm. But if you ask people directly, what do you believe? You get a different picture.
And Leif, the study that you have just done found something different, but you did it exclusively in Norway, is that right?
Yes, so our participants come from a highly sexually liberal country, highly gender egalitarian country, and highly secular country. So these are three things that can influence people's sexual psychology. First, we had different sexual behaviors, promiscuity, which is having sex with multiple, many partners, different types of self-stimulation, masturbation, and behaviors that were more akin to cheating and controlling and jealousy.
Okay, so if I have a friend and I'm trying to recommend to that friend whether he or she should hook up with someone or have a relationship with someone who's promiscuous, what were your findings there?
In the short-term setting, we find that there is a greater leniency towards women's short-term history, or sexual history. So if your friend isn't considering a short-term relationship, we'll be more lenient towards her having had a sexual history than him having had a sexual history.
So if I'm understanding you, it's reversed here.
So for long term, we find a single standard, and for short term, we find a reversed double standard.
So it's worse to be, in this case, a guy who's been recently promiscuous if you're, I don't know, entering the dating scene, right? Because then you're going to be viewed, at least in Norway, as a less desirable partner.
This is what we found. And it's driven by different aspects. One of the aspects is that women have a higher sexual disgust than men. So in general, women are more negative to sex or more negative to sexual behaviours. And when men consider women who masturbate and when women consider men who masturbate, there is a difference in how much of a turn-on that is.
What is that difference exactly?
Women who masturbate sound sexy. Men who masturbate sound disgusting.
Really?
Why is that?
Because men have a general higher sociosexuality. So men are more geared towards short-term sex to start with. Women are more reluctant or less, what shall we say? Their general level of turn-on is lower and their general level of sexual disgust is higher.
Gabe and I grew up in a time and a place, and that was the United States in the 1990s. And this myth wasn't a myth. I can hear guys, you know, in the schoolyard or in the courtyard calling women nasty names. The girls at that point who'd had quite a few boyfriends or who had already had sex. And it didn't go the other way at that time. So I guess my question is, why did that happen then to us? Why were we surrounded by that?
Well, I think it's important to then ask you, at what age?
I'd say 12 to 18.
Yeah, 13, 14, 15 in particular.
Yeah, so according to some other myths, there are no people who are more sexually conservative than prepubescent or pubertal boys. So boys around 14 years old seem to be extremely conservative. That doesn't necessarily say much about how this works among adults. The other thing is, I think it's worth noting that the US is less secular. It's more religious. It's more conservative by far than Europe, and especially Norway. And also, I think in terms of sexual equality, it's also quite far from Norway.
And again, that was Leif Edvard Ottesen Kinnear talking to us originally from Norway and reminding us that at the individual level, we don't judge people the same way as we think people judge each other at the societal level. And that for a lot of you out there, if you're in the dating scene, that's what really counts. Who cares about society? You're sitting across the table from one other person.
Yep.
That's fundamentally what matters.
What do you guys have to say about it? Let us know at su@dw.com.
Connor here. Gabe is on vacation, a well-deserved summer vacation. And what we're about to talk about, or the expert we're going to talk to in just a minute here, is connected to something that I've always sort of inwardly and sometimes outwardly laughed about here in Germany. And it's the fact that Germans are really, really conservative about home ownership. If you're going to buy a home in Germany, you'll have the Germans that you talk to look at you like you're dropping an anchor. You are setting yourself, in one spot for life. This is it. This is how Germans tend to think about it. I come from a country where houses are flipped like pancakes and you move 17 times maybe in your life. And that's just how it is. A home is a place you temporarily stay, or a house is a place you temporarily stay. All of that said, there is new research that supports the idea that when it comes to long-term mental health, the Germans might actually be right.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, I'm Clive Sable. I'm a professor of epidemiology at the University of Plymouth. And I've recently published a paper together with colleagues from Manchester in the UK and Aarhus in Denmark on childhood experiences and adulthood depression.
Clive, the biggest takeaway from your study, what was that conclusion?
What we found was, really interestingly, that if you moved as opposed to not moving, there were many more cases, almost 1.6 times more cases of depression compared to people who didn't move.
And it was very specific to one age range, right? Like if you were a kid and you moved between what, ages 10 and 15 years old, that was enough to develop this strong correlation or association with much more depression later?
That's right, yes. I mean, we did look at children from age 0 to 15, but from age 10 to 15, we found, as I said, 1.6 times more cases than if you didn't move.
Okay, so I'm a kid, I'm 12 years old, and my parents decide to move and then maybe move a second time before I turn 15. There's a 60% higher chance that I'm going to develop depression. What, in the next couple of decades?
Yeah, from adulthood, so from 18 years onwards. But let me caveat that a little bit. The rate of depression is very low. It's just 1.6 times or 60% more chance of a very low number.
Of course. I think the what did the WHO say? 3.8%? Of the global population suffers from depression. I think those numbers were reflected roughly in your study.
It's about that, yes, yes.
But even still, the association, I mean, having a 60% increase is still a lot. That, I mean, what is going on there?
Well, we did think of lots of things that could have explained it. First of all, we did account for, or statistically, we adjust for family circumstances. So whether the family comes from a deprived background, whether there's been something unfortunate with the family, such as a parental death or imprisonment, whether the mother is or the father has a very low age at the child's birth. But after we've adjusted for all of that, what we really think is it's a breakdown of the social networks that children have or potentially have when they move house.
Okay, so if my parents move, and let's say it's a happy family unit, I go home and I have this warm feeling. We move houses and everything in theory is still warm and happy. But now what exactly has broken down in my new life, or what isn't there that was there before?
So I should say that we don't have data on what breaks down, but what we are suggesting might be the breakdown in social ties. So friendship groups, you probably at that crucial age in your schooling change schools. If you belong to sports organizations or maybe you go to church, all of these things, you would have breaks in those ties. The other side is that the neighborhoods that you live in are also broken down. The moves that we classified were significant moves. It wasn't like moving next door or moving to the road next door. It was a big move. It had to be at least one that would involve a change of school.
Ah, okay. So you're completely upending your social life in this case.
Well, that's what we supposed. Yes, yes.
And real quick, you looked at, what was it, a million people in Denmark?
Yes, yeah, so everybody who was born in Denmark between, I think, the early 80s and 2003, 2004, who was born to Danish parents who lived there throughout the period of their lives from age 0 to 15.
For the parents out there who are going to have to move, a lot of times it's the nature of the job, are there any tips for them? how to best ease that transition for their kids, but also, frankly, for themselves. I mean, you looked at kids, but I'm not sure adults deal with a move very well either, really, if it's a major one. Any tips for all of our listeners out there on how they can minimize some of these negative consequences?
I've got to be a little bit cautious because this is not my area of expertise. Our data doesn't tell us about how to best mitigate the problems. But speaking as a member of the public, I can say that preparing the child for the move is the best way of initiating the discussion and perhaps getting them involved in the decision-making process. You know, mum's got a new job. We think we might have to move. What do you think about it? Do you think we should do this? That kind of conversation really helps.
Your paper highlights what is clearly a negative aspect for children in being moved, at least between the ages of 10 and 15. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of other research out there that might suggest that there are benefits, a different set of benefits for those same kids? I don't know that they're forced to socially grow or to become more bold in making new friendships. Is that also true or is it not?
I'm sure there is literature out there that would talk about that kind of thing. I'm not personally aware of it, but I'm interesting anecdotally, since we've had the paper published, I have had a lot of people email me. They fall into two categories. Some are saying, I had a childhood where we moved a lot and I think that really affected me in adulthood. And others are saying, we moved a lot and I think it just made me stronger. It made me more resilient. So it might be that it goes both ways.
Can I ask, did you have to move a lot when you were a kid?
I moved once when I was age 11.
So in that age range, how did you experience that?
It was a change of school. It was a very positive change of school. I moved from the city to the countryside. And I do remember I completely changed my friendship groups. That was in the days before social media, obviously. And I do remember it as being an upheaval. But reflecting back on that in adulthood, I think it was the best thing my parents could have done for us as a family.
Everyone, so far, it seems, every article I've read about your study has latched on to the children being moved aspect of your research, when in fact there's another big element of that paper that is very, very important. Could you just talk a bit about the low-income neighborhoods?
Yes, so we actually started off the study by hypothesizing that people who came from deprived or low-income neighborhoods would have worse depression than people coming from higher-income neighborhoods. And that indeed is the case. But the amazing finding we found was that if you didn't move but came from a low-income neighborhood, that you had lower chance of adulthood depression than if you moved but lived in a rich neighborhood.
Interesting. So yes. if you're in a deprived neighborhood, a difficult environment, but you stay there, then your mm-hmm. mental health outcomes are better as an adult than if you had actually moved out and possibly even, in quotation marks, upward toward a nicer neighborhood?
Exactly. Yes. It's a really interesting finding. And that's why we suggest our findings point to this idea of the breakdown of the social network and the support structures that gives you.
And that was Professor Clive Sable talking to us from Plymouth University in the UK. One thing he mentioned there was that he's been getting emails from people telling him their personal stories and how moves at a young age affected them into adulthood. I would love to hear the stories. If you yourself moved at a young age, or if you were the parent who caused the move in a child, what happened? How did it affect you? I'm interested, really interested. SU@dw.com. Thank you.
DW. Made for Minds.